This Sunday, the Abbey Theatre will host a wonderful event celebrating the work of Oscar Wilde, organised by the Josephine Hart Poetry Foundation. Author Merlin Holland, Oscar Wilde's grandson, and celebrated actor Simon Callow will talk and perform from Wilde's prison masterpiece, The Ballad of Reading Jail. The event is sold out, but I am delighted to say that both Merlin Holland and Simon Callow are with me in the studio right now. And thank you so much to both of you for being here with me.
Thank you.
Simon, a lot of people in this country will know you from both screen, obviously, and stage, and particularly in screen. They'll know Four Weddings and a Funeral. They'll know Garrett, and we'll talk about that, the Richard Curtin movie, at some point. But there's several one-man shows in there as well, and quite often about writers, quite often about performance. Charles Dickens, Orson Welles, and your connection to Oscar Wilde, in fact, goes back to one of the great shows about Oscar Wilde.
Yes.
And Micheál MacLiamore.
Exactly, the best. And interestingly enough, I had heard Michael MacLiamore do that show on a record. He made a couple of LPs of it when I was 16 or something like that. And so when I heard, I was at Queen's University in Belfast, when I heard that he was coming to Queen's to perform it as part of the Irish University Drama Association, I said, I have to interview this man. And they sent me down with an ancient old tape recorder to Harcourt Terrace, and I interviewed MacLiamore. And it was really, I think, one of the most astonishing experiences of my life, because I knew that I was interviewing a man who had played Oliver Twist to Beerbohm Tree's Fagin in 1913. And as a boy, had been at the first night of the Rite of Spring when it was performed in London for the first time, a week after it had been performed in Paris. And I and Michael was like nothing anybody had ever met, which was, he seemed to embody a vanished age completely. And his connection to Wilde was a very interesting one. He wasn't an absolutely abject admirer of Wilde. He was quite critical of him in some ways, but he plugged into that world because he had acted with actors who had been in the original productions of Wilde's plays. The Beerbohm Tree, for God's sake. Mm. And there was an extraordinary sense of authenticity about what he produced on stage. And when I was asked to do the show years later in London, I turned it down several times.
The importance of being earnest.
Yes.
Or, sorry, the importance of being Oscar.
Because I thought, how can I get away from the shadow of this extraordinary, exotic and remarkable man? But I think that his play, I hope Merlin agrees with me, the importance of being Oscar is a wonderful distillation of many aspects of Wilde in a most fantastically theatrical and imaginative way. And it contains quite a big chunk of course, The Ballad of Reading Jail.
Tell me you still have that tape sitting somewhere.
What, the tape with Michael? No, I don't think so. In fact, if I remember rightly, it broke down because the machine was so ancient. So I kind of made up what I remembered of his replies in the best journalistic traditions.
And Michael, Micheál MacLiamore tradition too.
Exactly, yes. And he dropped me a card and he said, "This was the most wonderful interview I've ever given with anybody. You quoted me so accurately." Now,
whether that was a pointed remark or not.
Exactly, I'll never know.
But interestingly, I think, Merlin, you would pick up on that, on something that Simon said there about Micheál MacLiamore's attitude to Oscar Wilde, which is that he didn't want to necessarily lionize him. You don't like the idea of totally lionizing your grandfather. You want the warts and all to be in there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think Oscar, warts and all, is Oscar in three dimensions. And, you know, right up until the publication of The Letters in 1962, it was very much Oscar Wilde, first-rate funny man struggling to rise beyond the second division of literature. And once we got The Letters and The Correspondence, Oscar became a reality. He became somebody who had all his faults. And I think it was from that moment that people began to revise their whole opinion of him. To go back for a second to Micheál MacLiamore's importance of being Oscar, well, the interesting thing is that there's Act 1 and Act 2, and in the programme of the time it says there will be an interval. During the interval, the trials of Oscar Wilde are deemed to have taken place. That's all it said. And I suppose Ireland in the time, that's all that one could produce.
Possibly so. And interestingly enough, you mentioned, Simon, that he worked with actors who would have been involved in the first productions of Wild Plays.
Yeah.
And therefore, he worked with actors and he knew people who were in theatre at the time of those trials that Merlin mentions to us. Did he talk about the kind of reaction that those people had? How does British theatre, London theatre, react to those trials?
Oh, well, with shock and horror. I mean, it was a catastrophe for the gay community, such as it was. It was a disaster. And the shadow of it spread right across the 20th century, really, right up until the 1967 beginnings of the repeal of the anti-homosexual legislation. But Michael said that, of course, it couldn't be talked of at all. And when he asked his father about it, he just said that he was the wickedest man who ever lived, and you must never, ever discuss him ever again. And that's, you know, that blight, it was the most spectacular trial. It couldn't have been more internationally famous what happened, and the sense of shame and dread and fear which overcame people about their own sexuality was profound, and it must have affected Michael too. And it wasn't really until Michael left England that he was able to address his own sexuality.
Merlin also mentioned the letters there, which I think in 1965 we got the letters.
62.
Yeah. And you read those letters again, even before you met Micheál MacLean.
Yeah,
you read the letters, Simon.
The first book I ever bought was Rupert Art Davis's wonderful first collection of those letters, and where you, of course, read De Profundis for the first time. That was astonishing revelation, that. Because people, up to then, because they'd only known the abbreviated versions in which so much had to be omitted for legal reasons, initially, of course, because Alfred Douglas could have prosecuted, presumably.
My father was very reluctant initially to have the letters published. I think it was something which took him back to his childhood and the pain of the separation from his father because of the homosexuality, and so on and so on. And it was only when he consulted Rebecca West, a very old and wonderful friend of his, and she said to him, "I feel strongly for you about this, but it's better that they should be published now rather than by nameless wolves and jackals at some time in the future putting all the wrong interpretations on them." And my father said, "You're absolutely right. Let's get them all out now in 1962. And if you look at some of the Hansard reports of the debates which were going on right up until 1965, only 2 years before the Act was repealed, it is shameful to see the attitudes of some of the MPs and even of the Lords at that time. Remarkable homophobic invective being voiced in the Houses of Parliament.
Do we get details within those letters of what happened, in fact, to your father, you know, when his father then was on trial, and his mother, Constance, went, she was there with the trials, but then the boys were sent back? What exactly happened there, and is that detail within the letters?
No, it's not, no. I mean, Dad didn't really come out until my father wrote his own autobiography in 1954, and that was, 60 years after the event. But no, that didn't come up. The one thing that people don't know, in fact, is that his wife, Constance, stayed on until after the second trial that Oscar had, being prosecuted by the Crown, and stayed on 2 weeks after the end of that trial, just in case her husband got off. That's loyalty for you.
Mm. And your father and his, and your uncle, wasn't it? Two boys?
Yeah,
your uncle, sir.
Yeah.
They were sent to Switzerland?
They were sent off to Switzerland with the governess, and but that was before the trials, the prosecution trials, the prosecution of Oscar for what was quaintly called gross indecency, before that all took place.
And that explains the name Holland as well. It was subsequent to the
trials. It was an old name on my grandmother's side, yes. Yeah.
You mentioned, Simon, about De Profundis, and you performed, was it last year, you did a version of De Profundis, a Frank McGuinness version of De Profundis, in fact. I think, Merlin, I think you have said that De Profundis is kind of the great precursor, the great preparation in many ways for the Ballad of Reading Gaol.
Oh yes. If you read the Ballad of Reading Gaol in the light of De Profundis, it gives it an even greater personal intensity. which happened when we did this thing last year, Merlin and I, and I having just come from doing De Profundis, was astonished by...
This was the Frank Biggers adaptation.
Yeah, Frank's version. I was astonished by how much it informed my own reading of it. It was white hot, because it came out of that... When you know what Wilde actually went through day by day, that the whole... And the fact that The Ballad of Reading Jail is really not exactly autobiographical. It's about somebody else, but about the world of the prison and the horror of all of that. It's so personal. It's so telling. It's an astounding piece. In a sort of form of verse that he never really used before. The ballad is not his natural form, and he created something utterly original and powerful.
Because I think for many people, the name Oscar Wilde is synonymous with wit, with repartee, with, you know, a satirical look at the society of the day. But De Profundis and The Ballad of Reading Jail are a different Oscar Wilde. Where do you place them, particularly The Ballad of Reading Jail, since that's what people will be hearing at the Abbey as part of this performance on Sunday evening?
Well, I think it's, as he said in a letter to an old friend when he comes out of prison, he said, "I was living a life unworthy of an artist." The disgrace, the pain, the isolation, they were a terrible fire. And fire either purifies or it destroys. And I think the what prison, this terrible fire, did to him is that it singed the aesthete, but it scalded the artist. And after The Ballad, that was it. There was never another piece of literary work. Oscar wrote some wonderful, wonderful letters. He kept that sense of humour right up. I mean, humour in adversity is something which is a great gift which some people have, and he had it in spades.
Although he sort of loses it in De Profundis. That's not...
That is true.
There is no humour.
Except there's one point in there when he says, he's talking about Christ, and he says, of course, there were many Christians before Christ, but there have been very few since.
No, you can come over the line like that.
But as you said, the one joke in all the...
Are there many in The Ballad, would you say?
No, that's him at his most absolute and serious. And The De Profundis is a partly deranged document. He was the experience of being in prison for a man, as you could imagine. Oscar Wilde had scarcely ever had anything less than a three Michelin star meal in his life before he went into prison, and the shock of that, physically, and then the sense of shame and degradation that they forced on him. It was like crushing a butterfly on the wheel, you know.
And the Ballad of Reading Jail effectively is, in many ways, it's the story not of Oscar himself in prison, but the story of this young man who's sentenced to death.
Yes.
That's the story he's telling us here.
Charles Thomas Aldrich, who murdered his wife. But the interesting thing, you know, is that in the ballad, there is a paragraph where Oscar says, when I come out of prison, I'm quoting very loosely, when I come out of prison, I know that what I have to do is to write one more work of literature, to rob malice of its venom and rip out the tongue of scorn by its roots, something along these lines. And of course that turns into the ballad. He knew that in order to put this prison experience in perspective, he had to write about it, and he knew this was going to happen. And there's at a point in the ballad he even knows that coming out of prison as an ex-prisoner, he says, society takes upon it the duty to punish people, but abandons them at the very moment when the prisoner needs it most on his release. I mean, for a man who's never been in prison to understand about prisoners' rehabilitation as he did.
And didn't he send money then to help prisoners when they came out as part of the...
Oh, he sent the equivalent of about £50 or £60. Oh, not the equivalent, £50 or £60. Of course, today probably it's £5,000 or £6,000.
Yeah, quite a lot.
To 10 or 12 prisoners, I think.
Yeah.
To solicitors in Reading, so that they £1, £2, £3 here and there, in order that they could put themselves back on the rails after they'd come out of prison.
It is a ballad, and therefore it is, you know, to be spoken or to be sung in lots of ways. To what extent, Simon, do you think in particular the ballad that you will be performing, reading, whatever way we want to put it, on Sunday evening, is it a piece that really comes to life off the page rather than on the page?
Well, both, actually. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to read in your study, but once you get those pounding rhythms going and those regular rhymes, it has a hypnotic power of its own. It's a sort of an incantation in a way. And of course it deals with more than just prison, because it deals with love and, you know, the famous and terrible phrase, each man kills the thing he loves. A terrible phrase. I mean, I don't know absolutely whether that's true, but you can understand from his perspective.
It's a line that anybody will quote. They may not even know the origins of that, but it's such a quoted line.
Yes, indeed.
And echoed later on when he comes out of prison and gets back with young Alfred Douglas and is accused by his friends of destroying his life again. And he says, I went back to Bosie because he offered me love. How could I not love him? He ruined my life.
One of the things that you do as part of the performance, Simon, is that you read some, before you go into the ballad itself, you read some material which you would say kind of almost predicts what he's going to write about in the Ballad of Reading.
Yes.
Shorter poems.
Yes, a couple. Well, one's just called The Harlot's House, which is a kind of rather lurid melodrama, but it's not unlike the life that he led himself at some point later. But the most remarkable poem is the one with which Michael McLearmore started his show, which is called Hélas. And it may be just worth reading now, because it's got a sort of haunted quality about it. He says, to drift with every passion till my soul is a stringed lute on which all winds can play. Is it for this that I have given away mine ancient wisdom and austere control? Methinks my life is a twice-written scroll, scrawled over on some boyish holiday with idle songs for pipe and virelay, which do but mar the secret of the whole. Surely that was a time I might have trod the sunlit heights, and from life's dissonance struck one clear chord to reach the ears of God. Is that time dead? Lo, with a little rod, I did but touch the honey of romance, and must I lose a soul's inheritance? It's a strange poem.
Simon Callow reading the Oscar Wilde poem, Hélas, which is part of the performance that he'll be giving in the Abbey Theatre on Sunday evening, part of the Josephine Hart Poetry Foundation, a reading of The Ballad of Reading Gaol, and that will be introduced on the night by Merlin Holland, Oscar Wilde's grandson, and both Simon Callow and Merlin are with me in studio this evening. That presaging of, if you like, of some of the themes that come out then in The Ballad of Reading Gaol, very interesting in terms of the picture of Dorian Gray, the novel, which I was saying this coming in, you know, you kind of think, that's Bosie that he's speaking about there. Now, never mind about who dies and who lives, just for the time. But, you know, you picture Bosie when you're reading Dorian Gray. But of course,
Lord Henry Wotton as the wicked sort of Svengali, if you like. The interesting thing is that Oscar wrote a letter to a totally unknown person, saying, "Lord Henry is what the world thinks me. Basil Hallward, the artist, is what I would like to be." Is how I imagine myself, and Dorian Gray is what I would like to be, dash, in other ages, perhaps. And if the prosecution, I always make the same mistake, if Edward Carson, at the time of cross-examining him, had that letter, the case might even have fallen apart sooner than it did.
Yeah, because the novel actually played quite a part in his downfall at that time.
Oh, it did.
In the public,
it was quoted by Queensbury's Marcus of Queensbury's solicitors as part of their plea of justification that he wrote this disgusting sodomitical novel, the book we give to teenagers today to understand the prose of Oscar Wilde. Unbelievable. It was put forward as, you know, you are guilty of the same things you write about.
It was an astonishing thing to write at the time, because it's on the, especially in the first version of it, as it first came out in installments, it is absolutely clear what's going on. It's a homosexual fantasy, and that he edited it down considerably.
Very, very uncharacteristically.
Very, yes.
Let's have a listen to something where Oscar Wilde is mentioned.
Do you actually know Oscar Wilde?
Not personally, no. But I do know someone who could get his fax number for you. Oh. Shall we dance?
Is it every interview or just every second interview, Simon, that Oscar Wilde is brought in that fashion? Well, from Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Indeed.
Gareth, and about to head into a Highland fling. Too many, one too many, in fact, isn't he?
Exactly. I mean, people often... I'm always delighted to say that in that film, a gay man was presented who didn't die of AIDS, because we were at the height of the AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
What he died of was Scottish dancing. It's basically a government health warning against the perils of Scottish dancing.
And it's the other thing that Richard Curtis, to be fair, in that movie also did, he presented two gay men in Garrett and the partners, and William is... Matthew is the partner's name, isn't it? They weren't the stereotypical,
not
very camp gay men. And that was quite a brave thing to do, I would have
Unbelievably,
thought.
One of the many reasons why I thought I absolutely have to do this movie, because, as I say, at the time that was an astonishing thing to do. And there is a line in it after Gareth's funeral, where... Hugh Grant says to James Fleet's character, you know, we've all been going around talking about getting married, all of us as a group, yet we never noticed that in the midst of our group was a true marriage, the only marriage in our group, and that was Matthew and Gareth.
At a time when even the idea of
gay marriage, same-sex marriage was not even on the horizon, you know, not on the radar. Amazing. It's a wonderful film from that point of view. And I remember Ian McKellen wrote to me after seeing it and said, this has done more for gay rights than all these lurid melodramas which are going on, like Philadelphia and so on.
And it must have broken your heart not to have been able to be part of the Red Noses, kind of a little mini sequel that was on for the comedy night. You couldn't be in it, obviously.
Well, we did actually film a prologue with me in heaven, but because they ran out of time on the night, they had to drop the prologue.
That's a shame. The other thing that was it today you tweeted this? I'm overwhelmed and honoured to be thought of as a possible Berko impersonator. But am I up to it? I've played Falstaff, Titus Andronicus and Richard III, but Berko? You'd need lungs of leather, a larynx of tempered steel and cojones of uncommon density. Okay, I'm on, says Simon Cowell. And this was in response to the idea that perhaps you could play John Berko, the Speaker of the House of Commons.
So it appears that the Twittersphere has gone mad with this idea that
well,
I should
Well, there's always
play
a
him.
Madness in the Twittersphere. It's always a storm. It's never something small, is it?
Indeed. But I think John Berko is doing a pretty good job of playing John. Somebody actually said, I thought John Berko had been impersonating Simon Callow all these years. So I was not very flattered by it.
How dramatic a scenario is it? You know, I know that some people have made fun out of this, the idea that, in fact, this is playing out like a big Shakespearean drama in front of you.
I don't know about Shakespeare. It's like Beckett to me. I mean, we're plunging into an abyss which is so incomprehensible to almost any of us. Not only what's going on at the moment, but the aftermath. How are we going to reconcile ourselves? It is, in effect, a civil war without weapons so far. And every day one reads another commentator who sagely and wisely interprets the situation, but the parameters are shifted again by the next day. I have no idea, to be honest with you, and I just wish that I could sleep for 20 years and wake up and find out.
But on a much more serious level, are there any other cast members that have been suggested to you? You're Berko, okay, you're the Speaker. Do you know who else is up for a part?
Well, Boris Johnson is clearly the part, but I don't know who, apart from Brian Blessed, perhaps.
Brendan Gleeson.
Yes, well, Brendan would be Moss.
Yeah,
yes.
I was casting him as it. Merlin, you, of course, were a bit ahead of the curve on the whole Brexit phenomenon. You have an Irish passport.
I do,
you're reaching into your pocket to show us. Yeah. Era Ireland on the front.
I did it quite a long time before Brexit raised its head. Your government actually put its hand in its pocket immensely generously and helped me repair and protect Oscar's tomb in Paris. And I thought the least thing I could do is, since I was allowed to, was to claim foreign birth registration and Irish citizenship. So I did. Mm. And my goodness, I'm glad.
Yeah. And travel will be easy. You don't have to worry about that side of things.
No, not at all.
Obviously, for the time being. You're in Dublin for the couple of days. The performance on Sunday night at the Abbey sold out, as I say, but it was great to hear your thoughts, and I'm sure people in the Abbey will hear more of that on Sunday. You're heading straight back. I know you're heading back to France. You're heading straight back on Monday. You're in the middle of work. What's happening soon?
I'm directing a film in January and February in Vienna, and I have to go and do some pre-production on that.
Well, good luck in whatever comes your way, and I hope you don't have to sleep for 20 years that we can solve things before that. Simon Callow, Merlin Holland, thank you very much for speaking to us this evening.
Thank you.